Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a drunken soiree in the within.
Chris and Stu present Hardcore Listing, the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Hardcore Listing Podcast. I'm one half of your presenting Joe. I'm Stu Whiffin. Sitting opposite me via the means of Zoom Media is
Christopher William Glasson.
I hadn't finished yet. I was actually going to big you up then.
You was not going to big me up. No, you've already told me that you got things you want to tear into me about this morning. So,
obviously we've long discussed your love of Warhammer and some of your more quirky nerdy things. I'm sure today's top five is going to bring out my inner nerd. So don't stress too much, but you've upgraded from a pair of headphones to, it looks like you're either doing telesales or gaming. Is that your gaming headset?
It's not my gaming headset, mate. I think some of the patrons have seen me sat with the gaming headset on with like chocolate cookies dribbling through my beard. this is sometimes a work headset because I've been running around the house trying to find my new headset this morning and I couldn't find it, frustratingly. So
you look like a proper big deal with that. You look well important.
Hold on, I've got someone on the other line, mate. Just give me a second.
If you had a little bit of a high V's, kind of sort of body warmer, big bunch of keys, I think you'd be looking well important then.
Oh, mate, I can only dream of it. Instead, I look, I brushed my hair with a toffee apple as usual this morning. So, yeah.
Well, for those that first-time listeners to Hardcore Listing, I'll explain a little bit about how this podcast works. We've been doing this for 4 years now, and what it is we get guests on. Sometimes we don't have guests; it's just Chris and I. And what we do is we pick a topic, and within that topic, we go through a top five and count down, your five faves within that topic. And I'm pleased to say we've got a guest today. Chris, would you like to introduce today's guest?
Yes, we have JP from Walden Parker, the band. Also a session musician, double bass, I believe, for a number of folk artists. And previously member of Nislopley, who you might remember doing the JCB song back in the day. Hey, JP, welcome.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Stu. How you doing?
We're good.
All good, mate. All good. Thanks for your time.
Good. I think your hair looks great, even though you've brushed it with a toffee apple. I don't have any hair, hence the hat. So,
I'm cruising towards that, mate. So don't worry. I think my friend always sends me pictures of razor blades and just with the caption, "Do the right thing." So,
that could be interpreted so many different ways.
If it was Stuart, I'd certainly interpret it a different way. You've had to put up with our level of abuse anyway.
Oh,
but
dear.
You're a good friend of my girl. I nearly said wife there. God, ideas above her station. But Molly, and she always speaks really fondly of you, mate. She's already told me that don't forget to invite JP down to Margate. So that invite is always open. And JP, recently, myself and you have got some similarities in what some of the things we faced over the last 5 to 10 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that's actually linked into you're running the virtual London Marathon soon to raise money for, is it Myton Hospice?
Myton Hospice, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and what was the reason for that, JB? How comes you done that?
Basically, about 7 years ago, my mum, Catherine, was diagnosed with vascular dementia. And I suppose the last 4 years I've been her carer at home, and obviously pretty much full on for the last few years. And she passed away in February. But before she sort of passed away, the end of life care, because you're so used to just doing everything, I didn't even think that actually people can come in and actually make that whole process, even just the physical lifting somebody, that sort of stuff, just so much easier. And Martin Hospice, which is a local charity to Warwick and Leamington, where I live, they were just amazing. They just came in, they were just lighthearted. They talked to my mum as if she was aware, you know, just, I learned so much in that short period with them. I wish I'd learned years ago and might have been a bit better carer. But so I promised my mum I would do something before she died. And I was like, well, I'm going to look after the garden, which I failed to do. And I said I'd run the virtual London Marathon, which I am in the process of training to do. Yeah, on October the 3rd.
How far have you run so far?
In one go, you mean, or?
Yeah, like I've
kind currently. Of. Currently. Sort
of, running throughout your life.
Don't ask me that.
No, I just like, you know, you don't necessarily run the full marathon ahead of your training, well, whilst training, do you? It's normally sort of 18, 20 miles, am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think partly to deal with the loss of my mum, I kind of embraced running at quite a full on. I don't really do things in small levels, so I was running 60 miles a week for quite a lot of weeks.
Wow.
So I've done a few 20 miles. I think the difficulty is I'm doing it on my own, so just carrying the right amount of fuel and food and drink and all that sort of stuff is hard. So I've definitely got it wrong. I've got a canal here. So there are a lot of boat owners that have had me stumbling on their boat going, I need something. I don't know where I am. Help. So that's the challenge of doing it on my own. But yeah, I've got a 20-mile race in Milton Keynes tomorrow. So that'll give me a good... Yeah, and then it tapers down, and I'm actually going to do the taper down, so I run less.
How do you do the virtual run? Have you got to go onto a treadmill to do this, or is it just you just set out a your own personal sort of run that's 26 miles and achieve that on the same time as everyone else?
Yeah, you kind of track it. I think I'll probably use Strava. I think London Marathon do send you something as well, but yeah, you've got to obviously prove you've done it and prove you've run it. I suppose you could just take your bike or sit in your car and drive very slowly. And at first I just didn't know where I'd be, because I'm a session musician. I could wake up anywhere and I still next day have to run the 26 miles. So I'm doing it locally at the moment, unless I'm gigging by, you know, short notice on October the 2nd. You never know.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I think... we can kind of put a tenuous link into this talk of gigging into your top five that you are choosing today.
But yes, let's pause that tenuous link, because we haven't yet had a warning from our sponsors. I mean, message from our sponsors.
Hello, this is Chaz from Love Beer. And I'm here to tell you about why I sponsor Hardcore Listening and what love-beer.co.uk does. I am a fully certified by the British Beer and Pubs Association for bar installation, with a focus on home and office bars. I have loads of home bar clients who have really enjoyed the service during lockdown, as well as corporate office clients like Facebook and HelloFresh. I offer a complete solution, from installing the bar equipment right the way through to keg supply. I also offer regular maintenance packages for those who want a bar without all the hassle.
Hello, this is Charles, also from Love Beer. I just want to also let you know I'm fully licensed to sell kegs. We can supply loads of different products, from mainstream beers and ciders right through to trendy craft beers and even Prosecco kegs, all delivered to your bar by a certified technician.
Also, why I'm here, have I mentioned the Landraver Beeries 3, which is a 45-year-old ex-MOD Land Rover Series 3? that we have done a complete restoration on during lockdown.
The Three Beeries 3 is a custom-built, high-performance bar hidden in the back of a Land Rover. The bar we have installed is capable of doing upwards of 500 pints per hour. We're about 4 to 5 weeks off having it all back together and ready to show it off. And I'll be launching an Instagram for it this week.
Nice one, Charles.
Nice one. Hello, I want to take a moment to shout out one of our wicked sponsors, eggfried.com. They are a streetwear brand. They produce t-shirts, sweats, hoodies, handmade denims. It's all inspired by hip-hop, punk, choir fashion. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, head over to eggfried.com and have a look on the website, because it's not just the design, it's the layout, it's the website. You know, the creative team over there are absolutely on point. There's just some great stuff there. And not just for adults as well. They've got Small Fried, which is their range of kids' clothes. And if you want your kid to just look beyond cool, like, head over and check that out. And they've given us a discount code, right, Chris?
Yes, Egg Salad. If you type Egg Salad into the discount coupon section, you get yourself a tidy little discount. And when they send out the stuff, it is packaged exquisitely. You get little goodies in there, stickers, and it's all wrapped up beautifully. So check out eggfried.com.
Okay, lastly, we want to thank, and certainly not leastly, we want to thank. Is leastly a word?
No, it's really not.
Right, we're going with it. We're going with it. So we want to thank Luke Van Boom. Luke Van Boom has a company called Bang Boom Creative. Luke is a long-time sponsor of this show and a friend of this show. If you see the pictures of Chris and I on the socials advertising this podcast, them happy snaps were taken by the genius that is Luke Van Boom. I mean, that's just the tip of what he does. Chris, do you want to explain a little bit more about what Bang Boom Creative does?
Yes, it's all about fresh, innovative production. So they're all about content with a heart and soul, making films of all kinds, shooting dynamic photographs and putting smiles on faces. They're passionate storytellers working with a diverse range of brands of all sizes. You know, their work includes short film, viral video, animation, hidden camera stunts, product demos, live action, 360 imaging and music promo. And they've worked with a ton of companies as well. Universal, BBC Children in Need, even the Mayor of London, Katie Piper, the NHS, the Dogs Trust. They've worked with a lot of companies.
It consistently blows my mind, you know, the stuff that you've just said there. Why does he have anything to do with us plums?
Stop talking him out of it.
Right.
Okay, back there. Thank you very much, our wonderful sponsors. She did go to do a nice segue before I slipped in the sponsors message there into JP's top five today. So what's your top five, mate?
I really struggled with this. I was like top five, and then I came up with really inappropriate things like girlfriends, and yeah, and then I was like, I can't do that. No, because that would be terrible. I wouldn't appear on any top five boy
band. Would that have been in like a High Fidelity style or...
Well, yeah, that's a
good
point.
Was you literally just ranking your girlfriends?
I think I was going to rank them. And this is,
personality,
yeah.
Eight.
yeah, a little bit like those trump cards that you get when my nephews love. So you're like, yeah, strength, ability, and, you know, anyway, I'm going to stop.
Stop there.
Oh, sorry. So I apologise. So I went with... my top five, which is my inspirational kind of favorite inspirational gigs I've been to and gone, oh man, I still want to do music, or I want to do music, depending on. And weirdly, a lot of these come years ago, a lot of the gigs I chose. So yeah.
Okay. Is your first gig you ever went to on this list?
It was originally, yes. Yeah.
But it's not now.
No. Yeah, I go to a lot of gigs, it seems, and then I was running yesterday and I was like, oh, I haven't included that one or that one, and that was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, my first gig was Status Quo when I was about 11, a free gig in Birmingham. And honestly, it's one of those things where you just see something and you go, I mean, I've never heard anything so loud in my life. I mean, it's not the coolest gig in the world, but it's like, they were great. They were really good. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to do that. I want that hair now more than anything else.
Like your first gig is cool regardless of what you're doing. I remember going to see my first live band, and I think it was at the Brush Stew, actually. Right. So it's the place that Stu has been a promoter for the last 50, 60 years. And I remembered on the sound check, someone was just doing the kick drum and I was already nodding my head and my friends were like, Chris, that's not the band starting. I was like, oh, okay. So like overwhelmed by the whole thing. I was so excited.
You should, that would have made the drummer's day, because when you watch drummer soundcheck, I don't know if you're going to agree with this, JP, but certainly in the bands that I've been in over the years, like when a drummer gets attention on just him and they'll go floor tom, snare, and they're just waiting for that moment, floor tom, they're just waiting, whole kit please, and that is the money shot for the drummer. He is in fucking heaven. He just gets about 30 seconds of all eyes on him, no other band member playing, just the drummer. Oh, our old drummer was just shocking for it. Literally, the engineer would be like, floor tom, and one of us would go, whole kit please, and he'd just go before he even touches any other drums. Just the wrong engineer. Oh, yeah, I digress. Sorry.
Drummers don't often know when to stop to do that either. I've done lots of tours where drummers do that and they've had their moment in the sun and you go, okay, you can go back in your box now. And they're still sitting there going, what's the bass sound check now? Yeah, but you know, you want some drums when you play. No, I don't actually. They're a special breed.
Oh dear. So, okay, well, what's number five then, JP?
Number five is Spearhead, Michael Franti's Spearhead.
Wow.
So my old band, Lizloppy Plet, got the pleasure to play Lowlands in the Netherlands in, 2006. And weirdly, I believe we were on just before them or just after them. All I remember was thinking, oh my God. They were amazing. It was like, I'd never seen a band so big do and sound so kind of funk groove based. Like it was a special gig.
And so am I right in saying Michael Franti was Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy before Spearhead, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
He's awesome. Honestly, he could lead a revolution. You look at him and go, I'm going with him. He's cool. And the whole audience were like that. It was just pogoing the whole set. Even in the ballads, people were still bouncing up and down, a bit like your drum soundtrack, you know.
How does it feel for you, you know, when all of a sudden the band you're in was getting, you know, huge commercial success and you was finding yourselves on bills, you know, playing with people that, you know, you was, you know, as a theme of this podcast is inspired by, you know, did you ever have imposter syndrome? Like when you was on, you know, walking into these kind of arenas and stuff and thinking, oh, blimey, look, there's blah, blah, blah over there. We're playing with them. Like, you know, how was that for you as an experience?
Imposter syndrome. You know what? I didn't. I think mainly just because I really chose this kind of success I knew would be kind of short-lived. So I kind of really chose to just fully embrace it. Just, you know, like, feel a little bit like the Red Hot Chili Peppers every time you get up on a big stage, because you knew that you weren't going to be on these big stages forever. And it's so loud and it's so like, oh my God, this is so much fun. This is their lives all the time and I get to do it once. I'm going to go for it. And it is also like inspiring to see how these big bands, like Michael Franti, Spearhead, they just tour and tour and tour every night for years on end. And just, you know, when you see like a positive band that sound amazing and they all get on, they're like, it's a good team of people. And that's the perfect touring life, you know, when you look on stage and they look happy, but from the side of the stage, they are genuinely like really pleased to be there.
Yeah. I have a calm and consistency with it. Because if you're going to tour for that long, you need that, don't you? With your band members, I guess.
Absolutely. And as a session musician, quite often you're coming in as a kind of new guy and you're seeing all the dynamics and going, oh, right, okay, what's this what's this like on a year tour?
I guess you could do a top five of that if you dared surf out all the bands and that you've done sessions for. But I guess there could be quite a lot of conflicting artistic directions on music and stuff, and you have to kind of maybe sit there and wait out the the conversations on where they want to go with it before you record.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also sometimes you just, you know, certainly in the pop world, you meet session musicians who they're kind of living the dream, but it's also perhaps not the dream that they thought it was going to be. And they're there drumming behind some big pop star. No one knows who they are. They probably didn't even get to sound check their own drums, you know.
That's the bit that hurts.
Yeah, exactly.
So shall we have a little, we'll have another one. Let's have another one of your gigs and then we'll explore a bit more about the runs and the charity as well, JP. So what's your fourth gig, most memorable?
My fourth gig is they're a guilty pleasure. I don't know why they're a guilty pleasure, but they actually are. They're a heavy metal band called Metallica, which is a famous band.
Heard of them? I wouldn't have heard of them, but yeah.
Okay, yeah, they've sold a few records. I saw them... I've seen them a lot, but I saw them at Milton Keynes Bowl, I think in 93, so a long time ago. And I just loved it. I mean, I didn't like the bass solo or the drum solo very much, but at that age, I just wanted to be in a heavy metal band. I even had the hair and was like, I'm fully signed up. I can't really play, but that doesn't really matter. And they were just great. And then every time they tour, I like disappear around the time that they're playing anywhere near me. I don't tell anyone where I'm going and then just end up in a mosh pit. It's just, yeah, amazing.
Amazing.
What is it about, like, I mean, because in 93, in regards to sort of guitar music, there was a hell of a lot going on, you know, a hell of a lot. You know, you're looking at the stuff that was coming from the States, aside from Metallica, you know, was dominating, you know, the sort of music that was, you know, guitar music. And I always found it really strange. I've always struggled with Metallica.
Right.
I think I struggle with Hetfield. I do think that they've made the funniest music documentaries ever made.
The best, most accurate music documentary ever.
But when you were saying that, you know, you wanted to be in a band and you didn't think, you know, you could play that well at that point. When you've got bands like Nirvana playing very more straightforward kind of chords and, you know, I guess fundamentally punk, like, was you not sort of drawn to that? What was it? Like, was it?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Yeah, interestingly, you're right. I mean, it's when you meet young, you know, teenagers now and they want to play guitar, they're wearing a Nirvana t-shirt, Guns N' Roses t-shirt, or a Metallica t-shirt. And want to learn those records, which were all 90s guitar records. Mm. It's like, these are huge records. I mean, I was listening to REM this morning and I was like, wow. I even watched
What were you listening
to? I actually listened to Automatic for the people. I watched the documentary on it. There's one on YouTube.
What?
Yeah, I didn't realize it existed. Yeah, I think it was to celebrate 25 years, but...
Wow. All four of them?
Stuart's weekend sorted.
All four of them, yes, I believe all four of them.
Wow.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And lots of like, because they recorded that album in so many different studios across America, across the world, in fact. Yeah. So there's lots of footage of them in the studio. And yeah, it's an interesting record. It's really an interesting record. And obviously stands the total test of time. Amazing songwriting.
It's such a complex record. This is me nerd now. They're my favorite band. And like, when
you've got 60 seconds, Stu.
Okay. So, But to come off of Out of Time, which I think one of the greatest records ever made, to then come back, you know, at the, I guess before they, well, I guess they were one of the biggest bands in the world at that point, and obviously it went even further with Automatic. But to then come back and release your first thing, which is Drive, which is such a surreal record. It's as a lead single. You know, I don't know if the record company are like, whoa, this is not a Shiny Happy People or a Man on the Moon or a Sidewinder. This is a dark record that, yeah, and oh, it's so weighty. And the lyrical content on that album, I don't know what was going on in with Michael Stipe at that point, but yeah, it's a pretty hefty, heavy record that.
It is, yeah. He talks about that, why he chose to write. A lot of it is, it's a record of death and loss and all sorts of things. I think he cites it to do with what was going on in America politically, and there was the AIDS epidemic, there was George Bush, you know, all of that kind of frightening Reagan, all of that sort of stuff. I think Out of Time sold 10 million or something. I think the record label like just go and do what you do because people are buying it. So,
Well, I've had me 60 seconds and I have just gone off on a spiral there because you was referencing young kids in Nirvana GNR and Metallica t-shirts when they pick up a guitar. Sorry, I'll just...
No,
it's going to happen when you mention bands like that. I'm going to go overexcited.
I think you did well to keep it to that, Stu. JP, I just want to touch on something you said on a previous round, is you didn't think, you know, you just made the most of it with Nizloppy. Or you didn't think it was going to be a spearhead, like maybe, because I think that's a better way to look at it, no matter what artistic pursuit is, just enjoy it for how long that exists for, because sort of like that level of fame is often just, it's quite transient and lucky, and you know, obviously it requires quality, and I think Nizloppy had that. But this kind of ties into, even though that, you know, that isn't what's currently going on now, it was quite inspiring. There is a legacy there, because I mean, even people like Ed Sheeran, I think they was Ed, he toured with you. Was he like a guitar tech for you, like back in the day or something like that? Or
yeah, we always felt, because I was terrible at school, so I just wanted to play at the time electric bass, and that's all I did. I just would skip school and just ride around playing electric bass. I don't know how I rode a bike and played bass, but I seem to have done it. So we ran our own label. We were an independent band, and we just thought it was really important to have work experience students. So they spent a week in the office doing the really boring stuff that musicians have to do nowadays, you know, basically admin. And then they get a week on the road in a kind of very non-glamorous back of van gig. And Ed was one of those where he came and helped with the guitar tech stuff, selling some merch, that sort of thing, really. Hung out very young, loved the band, and just wanted to know, you know, like old school, really, like, what chord is that? How does that go? Why did you do that? And it's good for us because you were like, oh, I don't know. No idea. I just woke up and went, oh, that sounds good. And he watched Luke, especially Luke's performance. It was very good at going into the crowd and singing acoustically, and Ed does a lot of that. It has a legacy in the you know, like in the same sense that Van Morrison or Tom Waits or whoever has influenced me, or, you know, music is beautiful like that, isn't it? Like, you know, you can just...
and he he definitely influenced, you definitely influenced him to the point where I remember listening to Ed on Desert Island Discs maybe a couple of years ago, and he chose one of your tracks.
Yeah.
And he, you know, quite openly said, you might sort of think this sounds quite a lot like what I do. and you know, I hadn't heard that track, and I was like, and my wife's a massive Ed Sheeran fan, and I was like, are you hearing this? it really does, like, sound like what Ed was doing, which I guess it's lovely, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I actually did some recording with him when he was doing his EP, so before his major first record success. A lot of those songs were on EPs. So he was gigging really hard, and he paid me, and I was like, you don't have to pay me, it feels really awkward, but he was really keen to pay everybody, and so in that sense, at one point we were playing together, so it was very, very misloppy. We're definitely an influence. And a lot of people have said, kind of the negatives, don't you get upset that he's sort of, that people sort of accuse him of ripping off our sound? And it's like, well, we're not doing it.
Yeah.
And you could, I mean, as a double bass player, there's a bass player called Danny Thompson, and he influences me loads. So, yeah. You know, but the fact that he name checks us, and it's just, yeah. It's great.
He's always embraced that, and you know, like you say, artistically, it's kind of everything feeds onto each other. And I think if you're not trying to be pretentious and like ignore that, then it's all well and good. And it's you can hear that. It's really cool to hear. And Ed's actually contributed to your marathon run, right? Because Molly was like, "Oh my god, Ed's just given you a couple of quid as well."
He has. Yeah. He sponsored me 10 grand. Just a pile on the pressure.
Incredible. Well, you better get a new time on Strava then, JB. Or he's going to take it back. That's incredible, man. Because that's been, I think that's hit some of the news outlets, hasn't it? So it's been written about in a few of the papers now. Guardian, I think, might have mentioned it, and a few others.
Independent, The Times. Yeah, I got a picture of my mum in The Times. That's just hilarious. I'm not sure what she would have thought about that. She's quite a private lady.
Well, JP, honestly, that chewed me up. It's quite a sensitive thing for me. And even seeing that picture of you and your mum, I was like, I couldn't look at it for too long. I get a bit emotively linked to it. And I just, any time Molly would tell me about what you've been doing over the last few years and how that sort of like, it's like a slow gradient into, I guess, what you then decide into, that you were going to do it maybe full time as a carer. How did that journey start for you and your mum's when she got diagnosed?
Originally I just finished a tour with Nisloppy, and I was on stage and I got a phone call from my sister to say something very wrong with your mum, and this was about 7 years ago around Christmas, and I said, I'll put her on the phone. I was literally just on the way up onto a stage, and she handed the phone to my mum. My mum had no idea who I was, what was going on. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to go. So, my mum wouldn't accept any help. So I had to pack down, drive from London to the Midlands. And it turned out she had all sorts of things had gone wrong, and she'd perforated her bowel. And so she had sepsis. And if I hadn't come home, she would listen to me for some reason. And I managed to get her into hospital, and she wasn't supposed to survive, and she did. She's a fierce Irish woman. You don't cross her. She's from Dublin. And she just, you know, I remember in the ICU, she was, when she started to come to, she was pulling at the tubes, and me and my brother were having to hold her down because she was just like, I want out of here. It's like, no. And really that kickstarted something I think that was probably bubbling underneath, which was the dementia. And I moved home to do the physical care for 6 months. And then things were just not right, you know, like unusually not right. It wasn't that she was forgetful. It was like she'd look at a clock and the clock was this abstract thing. And I was like, well, that's not, is that memory? Or she just doesn't understand the concept of time anymore. Yeah. So what on earth? And once I'd got her diagnosed, I suppose really, I mean, my sister moved back in for a while. I guess maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I came back home. There was sort of a relationship breakup for me. So I came back home and I realized then she needed help. And we tried the carer's route. And, you know, some of them mean really well. Some of them are good.
Yeah.
The training is rubbish. The pay is horrific. Yeah. And so we had a lot of bad carers. And I was just like, I can't do this to my mum. So I was like, I'm a freelance musician. I can make it work. Do both. So I did that for a while. And then about 2 years ago, it was too much to do both. So I became basically a full-time carer. So, yeah.
It's really... That's a tough decision, JP, and it's I'm not there, and I don't know if I'll go be a full-time carer for my mum. I don't know if I'll make that decision, because kind of my dad and mum fell ill literally in the same month, got diagnosis, different ones, and then I ended up starting to get someone in just to make sure when I wasn't there that they would take their medication on time, because that's really all the care needs started as, and no matter how many alarms I put in the house, I couldn't remind my parents to take it. I could literally physically phone them and say, okay, take your meds now. And they'd be like, yeah, cool, hang up. And then between them, they wouldn't always take it. And like with, say, Parkinson's, which is what my dad started with, you've got to be regular with those dosages or else it sort of like plays. So I started like that with the with assisted help at home. And actually that's been, I was so lucky with the person that we had that, their responsibilities have just increased, which has afforded me to not make as I'm constantly having to risk manage at home and decide like what's the next step here. But I don't know if I will take on like do it full time myself. So for you to have to do that and the sacrifices it makes, it's quite overwhelming. And just well done for that, because it can be, I think I said this to you on message over there, it's quite bittersweet. It can be rewarding and you get there's a different kind of love that you form and a protection I have for my mum and dad and just more vulnerable people in general. But it's also tough, man. It can be quite like sad. Like even I'm quite an optimistic person, but there are some days where I just have to walk out the front door just for a second, because my mum unintentionally is like the perfect wind-up master. She knows exactly how like to wind you up because she's got no memory. So like every like 30 seconds, it's the same conversation driving you down the same pathways. And there's certain days where I've just got to like walk out.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
House.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that. God, yeah. Yeah, the thing is, what's interesting enough sometimes, because I was able to make the decision to stay at home, some people feel almost like by doing that, it's a judgment on them maybe not doing that or them putting parents into homes. But there were definitely, I'm going to be honest, there were definitely times where I thought, is this the right decision for her? Yeah, wasn't really so much about me. It was just like, and if I could have found the right care home with the right lovely people, and I thought that the care would have been better, because I obviously had to learn to feed her, to wash it, you know, those things I had to learn on the job, whereas people are trained, if they're trained well, they know how to do those things. So yeah, there were definitely times. And then there was just before the pandemic, I was almost in one of Robert Plant's bands. I went to see them, and We had a chat about maybe playing together. And that's one of those things we were like, oh no, it's not possible to do the Care and be in a big, you know, band like that. And then we're just really fortunate I didn't have to make any of those decisions, because then there was a pandemic. So, you know, thank God. We wouldn't have been able to see her. That's the, you know, I can't imagine what it's like for people who spent the last, you know, year or so really not being able to communicate or see their. I mean, we tried Zoom. There's four kids, four of us. We tried Zoom because we were shielding, and, you know, my mum would just get up and wander off when she was able to get up and wander off, you know, and then she'd just get very angry at the noise that Zoom makes. So, yeah.
Yes, it's tough. I mean, my brother's wife, her mum's in a care home, and that was an absolute nightmare for her, trying to see her mother, who's got vascular dementia. And it's been a real nightmare for her. So I really count my blessings, like getting to have my mum stay at home for as long as possible and be able to just watch her out in the garden talking to the robins is just, that's what it's about at the moment. And long may that continue. Yes, shall we have a switch of conversation? Shall we get your third gig, your number three in there?
Yeah, absolutely. This festival doesn't run anymore. It's a local festival called the Phoenix Festival. It was in Stratford. And there was a band called Lamb, an electronic dancey drum and bass band. And I saw them and I was like, oh my God, that. There was a guy playing this weird looking upright tall thing with four strings. And I was like, I want to play that. That's really cool. And yeah, just blew my mind. The energy, it was like tribal. really cool. I mean, obviously everybody was off their faces on various things, but the energy was, I mean, I wasn't, but it was just, you were washed along with just this euphoric. They were just amazing. And it was around the time, I think, of their first records. They had the Grecki, I think it was called, their big single, and all those strings. Oh, my God. Amazing. Great gig.
Lamb were great, yeah.
He actually taught me double bass, weirdly. I ended up in Manchester studying jazz. And, he was my instrument teacher. I was like, you're the guy from Lamb. And he was the best teacher in the world on a million and one levels. He sort of prepared me for what it's like when you get to bigger stages and all that sort of stuff, and so the pros and cons of it all, really. So yeah, useful man, lovely man, John Thorne.
Listening to that live music drum and bass thing, I remember I used to put on gigs and there was a band called Analog, which were kind of like a live drum and bass setup. And I put them on, and that was just such a buzz to watch those guys just perform.
Yeah,
it was really good. Before, what's that big one? What's the big band called now? That Rudimental.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, but Analog were amazing to watch for those sort of reasons.
There was a few, wasn't there? It was like Red Snapper. Do you remember them?
Oh yeah, Red Snapper were wicked. Yeah.
Ali Fiend and double bass. Yeah, they were awesome. I saw them a number of times. Incredibly loud though.
Didn't when they played live, didn't Ronnie Size have double bass player?
He did, yeah. Ronnie Size represent, yeah. That every time I turned up at a gig for a while, they were like, "Can you play?" Yes, Brown Paint for Bag. Which is great. It's better than the Jaws theme, which was often.
I mean, just touching on Lamb a little bit more. Like, I mean, Gorecki is a ridiculously incredible record, isn't it? And it just builds and builds and builds. And I've not seen them live. And the same, I think maybe a couple of albums later, it was almost a similar kind of pace to Gorecki with their single Gabriel. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Yeah, it's fucking hell, what a record. Mm. And shout out to the Phoenix Festival. Why did that disappear? Do you know what? One of the Wonder Stuff played their last ever gig the Phoenix Festival before countless comebacks. But all I remember was staying up and it was on Channel 4 or something like that. And it was like, and I think Faith No More played Phoenix as well.
They did. Yeah. Yeah,
and all I remember is Miles Hunt, who was famously, you know, quite a confident and by his own admission, gobshite. And they finished And obviously there's that kind of legendary quote from Lydon, "Ever felt like you've been cheated?" as he walks off stage. Miles Hunt just finished the last chord of the last song and just went, "Ever felt like you've been treated?" And just walked off, and I just thought, that's glorious. What a way to wind your band down.
God. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't know what, I think Phoenix, I don't know, because it was Long Marston, wasn't it? Oh, yeah, there was obviously some sort of local politics going on. There's a big sort of dance festival that happens there, I believe, like a rave, a legal one. But I saw Jamiroquai around the whole sort of acid jazz funk thing that was going on then.
Back when it was good. I loved that first record, Emergency on Planet Earth, and even Space Cowboy was pretty decent, and then kind of broke my heart because I started seeing like him driving around in Ferraris, and I was like, hold on, what was you was just singing about the complete opposite of that.
It was an emergency on Planet Earth.
Yeah. It was only an emergency because he couldn't afford the 12th Ferrari. and that can feel like an emergency. Yeah, I love that bass player, Stuart Zender. In fact, it was the year they released, oh God, oh, it was the album after those two amazing ones.
Traveling Without Moving. Was it Traveling Without Moving?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, but they played a lot of the first and second records, and it still had the great... The band was, you know, like a Stevie Wonder kind of band. It's just incredible. They were great. He came out on some sort of weird motorbike. He drove a motorbike on stage. It's like, okay, that's an entrance. You don't want to get that wrong. Yeah.
Number two,
weirdly, sort of madly removed and linked to Ronnie Size. I went to see Ronnie Size at an amazing venue in Manchester called the Academy 2. I saw them doing their thing. It was incredible. I think the next week I went to see a completely different gig, which is my number two, which is Gillian Welsh and David Rawlins. Just the two of them, kind of country singer-songwriter. She's got a devastating voice. And it was probably one of the best sounding gigs I've ever been to. And they didn't plug in. They were all mic'd up. And, you know, this is like a 2,000, 3,000 sort of. It was like, it was incredible. And because they were so, it was so intimate, the audience was so quiet. It was very, it was incredible. It was just the guitar sound. He plays this beautiful American acoustic guitar, and it just... Honestly, his solos are so weird as well. They sort of go off kilter, and yeah, just such a beautiful gig. And it proved to me that you could still do the intimate thing on a much bigger scale. And it really worked. It was a very powerful gig, very moving, and a very quiet audience.
Something you get used to at spoken word. When we used to do the spoken word circuit, I don't know when that was, mid-2000s. And, you know, when you used to go to the hardcore gigs, even if they were quite large, you could just hear a pin drop in them.
Yeah.
And, it's quite nice when you've got a crowd like that and you don't have, like, the drunkards at the back just talking over everyone. It's depressing.
Yeah.
But, one of my most inspiring ones, just to drop one in there, was Saul Williams. Me and Pip went to see Saul Williams play, and that was the same. Like, at the end of the gig, and I can't remember what record he was releasing at the time. It was the one that had Black Stacey on there. That's just an absolute banger. And he then did a 15-minute, like, just off the top of his dome, like, recital of spoken word. And the room was just absolutely dead silent. And it was just incredible. I remember just looking at Pip and thinking, he's still... talking. He's like 15 minutes on and he's still like doing this spoken word piece that was just absolutely amazing. And that was just before sort of Pip was really forming up his sort of like game plan for what he wanted to sort of do, and like being inspired by people like him and Sage Francis, who'd come on with just like a cassette player basically. And yeah, wonderful stuff. Yeah.
No, it's really weird. I don't know if you'll believe me, but I was looking at that and I was thinking of Saul Williams.
Oh, really?
That's because it didn't make my top five, but we played Austin, Texas, one of the South by Southwest things, and Saul Williams did a gig there. And we were just like, I don't care, we have got to get to this gig. So we turned up and Saul Williams started gigging. On his own, dressed as a Zulu warrior in fuck your arm from Texas or something on his t-shirt. It was just, he was unbelievable. And I can't believe it's not on my list. It was, yeah. Ugh. My God.
There's very few more talented people that I've ever seen on a stage, I guess, than Saul. I think, yeah, he's a bit of a powerhouse, really, creatively. It's overwhelming, really. I look at him and just think, bloody hell, how talented and passionate a person he is. So, yeah, I'd have loved to have seen that. Definitely. Yeah,
that first record was American. Oh, God. It was like, wasn't it produced by Rick Rubin or something? It was like, awesome.
Yeah, I forget. The first song I heard him on was off a Ninja Tune record. I Wanna Rhyme on Tracks. But it's been so long. Weirdly, you know when you just don't, you forget and you don't listen to an artist for like 5-6 years. I haven't listened to a Saul Williams record for so long, so I might have to bump that soon.
I bought one that Trent Reznor and him did, which was really quite off the wall. And it's quite like, I don't know how to get into this record. But, he's an interesting guy to follow on Twitter, or he used to be anyway. So, yeah.
One of the things that you was talking about sort of like acoustic acts and that kind of like, you said they weren't even plugged in, they were just mic'd up. I find that like something that I wouldn't even sort of consider as a gig goer, and I think it's really interesting as a musician that you know that's a fundamental there, you know, for a large audience. They've done that, and does that make it? I mean, explain how that would have been, why that was different from had they have like plugged their guitar and their bass in rather than it just be mic'd.
It's a good question. I mean, I think the audience didn't realize, like you said, they wouldn't have realized that, or a lot of them wouldn't have. They would have just, their behavior was influenced by it though, because the sound was quieter. It picked up all the little scrapes and niggles, and then when he would turn to her or she would turn to him, you could pretty much hear what they were saying to each other. And people wanted that. They were like, this is music that feels like it's actually happening in front of you, even though, you know, big electronic bands, it's still happening in front of you. There's just, it feels very real. I mean, it is very real. Every mistake, there's no editing, and the sound is just, it sounds like they are standing just in front of you playing, basically. You know, that horrible DI stuff going on. It's like, this is what the guitar sounds like today. My voice is at this quality today. Yeah. And that's kind of what live music should be about. Not to be purist, but it should just be about that moment. And if you're having a bad day, that should be reflected in your gig.
Yeah,
100%. But, you know, you do find a lot of artists saying if they're having a bad day, they can have a great gig.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I saw Ray Montagna once, and he was having a bad day, and he just let everyone know he was having a bad day. But the way he sang the songs was incredible, but he was pissed off. He was really pissed off. His banter was kind of funny because it was so negative, but yeah.
And one of the other things that, you know, as someone who's 48 now and like artists that I grew up listening to a nag doing gigs at the sort of South Bank Centre now, and I'm going to watch acoustic performances from, you know, Grant Lee Phillips and, you know, Evan Dando and people that I grew up. One of the things that is the big thing, irrelevant of whether they're mic'd up, DI'd or whatever, I'm getting to sit down when I watch them. That weirded me out. And it's like, hang on a minute. Last time I was in front of Evan Dando with a microphone, I probably would have had a long hair, a pair of shorts, and I was throwing myself all over the place. Now I've had a coffee and I'm sitting down. This is strange.
The coffee.
There's a stair lift to help you up onto the stage and a stair lift to help you down, and that's the equivalent of stage diving.
Yeah. Oh, dear. And what was weird was, I think in the sort of time between seeing Lemonheads and Evan Dando, I think he'd had huge battles with like some seriously hard drugs and that. He still looked 10 years younger than me. Still looked incredible.
But what we can learn from that is, in fact, the drugs work. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just don't want us to have them.
Exactly. Richard Ashcroft, you got it wrong, mate.
When you were talking, Stu, about bands there at the Embankment, I was so gutted because we were talking about drum and bass live performances. Goldie did Timeless with a live orchestra over that way. And there's tunes like Sea of Tears that he did that have got a double bass on that are just, they're so good. I was gutted I missed it. I can't remember the reason for it. But yeah, I'd love to have gone and checked them out.
I went to Wolverhampton Civic Hall. It was my first what I'd call an all-nighter gig. And yeah. Goldie and Metalheads, I think it was, they were headlining. It was their show. Epic. And I don't know why. I mean, clearly the venue must have closed at some point, but I didn't get home. I didn't get home until definitely 1 or 2 in the afternoon. The next
That's great.
It was an amazing, it was the full thing. I think there were lots of vocalists, more vocalists than strings, but my God, that was a good gig. That was also, I should have made the list. Damn. 5 is difficult.
When you said about, what was it, Jamiroquai coming on stage on a motorbike, you said there's a variety of ways it could go wrong. We were in the Civic, Wolverhampton Civic, me and Pip watching Head Planet Earth, which was like a new metal band, and the DJ came on. DJ, I want to say Warhead, but it isn't. He came on a skateboard, and he just straight unstacked it. His whole body was like the reverse direction in the air. And but you know what? It looked absolutely fine. He completely styled it. But yeah, it looked super painful. I was thinking, yeah, I don't think a stage is built for a skateboard, really.
No, it's always that thing where a drummer, the stage is like someone, he falls off the back of the stage, and you know as a musician, that's gonna hurt. Like, his pride is damaged, but his body is going, you fucking I've only fallen off one stage and not very publicly, so that's all right.
I'm also a big fan of watching boxers that make really flamboyant walks to the ring and then try and jump the ropes but get their foot caught on the top rope. That's a spectacular entrance, especially because you're about to have a fight and you want to look as tough as you can, and you just clip your toe and just roll into the ring. That's always a glorious entrance foul.
Holding your foot going, whoa, whoa.
Really hurt.
You don't understand. I mean, not that I want to get beaten up by any boxers.
Okay, so we're at the top spot, aren't we?
That was kind of difficult, but I think he's Tom Waits at the Apollo in 2004. It was his real Gone tour. And he makes it just because a lot of legends I've just never seen because they've been dead many, many years, or they're not very good now, or that sort of thing.
But before you get on to that gig, can I just ask you about that? Yeah. About legends and some of them aren't very good now. Will you go and watch them to tick the box?
No. Having done it a few times, no.
Come on, give us some names.
John Martin, he did the Solid Air album. It was horrific. Every Van Morrison gig I've gone to thinking, it's going to be, shit. You know, those sort of things where you're like, this record really means, I have to say, controversially, bless him, Paul Simon, Graceland. I sadly lost my dad when I was 15, and Graceland was the record that, I mean, just... Yeah, it means a lot to me. But when I saw him at Glastonbury, I was just like, man, the guitarist is in that key. You're in another key. You should stop now. And he has stopped now. I don't think because of me. I think it can really damage your... Yeah. Yeah, certainly if they're kind of grumpy. I think if their personality isn't like all love and warmth, then you're like, oh.
I mean, you've chose Paul Simon and Van Morrison. I think it's quite well documented. They're not jolly chaps.
No, they're not. They're not, really not. And you kind of wonder why. Why? If I'd recorded, I don't know, Astra Weeks and Graceland or whatever, I think I'd be pretty happy.
I think he recorded Astral Weeks in like 3 days.
I mean,
that's insane, right? I mean, that's arguably one of the greatest records ever made, in my humble.
Yeah. Although the first time I saw Van Morrison, he bollocked his bass player for a mistake on stage. And as a bass player, I think it was one of the Dankwoods, I think. Anyway, an amazing double bass player. It wasn't his fault. It was Van Morrison's fault. And he just humiliated this guy on stage. And I was just thinking, oh, I don't like you. at all. And then what makes me happy is, and it's awful, you shouldn't make me happy, but Astor Weeks, he doesn't make any money from that record.
Really?
Yeah, apparently it didn't sell at first. So I think like a Buddhist monastery or something get it, some sort of, yeah.
So amazing.
I think it's why he re-recorded it terribly much later. So yeah, so that makes me happy.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. I saw Brian Wilson. If I had to throw one in, I went and watched Brian Wilson do Pet Sounds maybe 5 years ago. In Southend, and I'm a huge Beach Boys fan, and I was unsure what I was going to get, but it was absolutely amazing. His voice he's quite fractured now, but Al Jardine was there with him, and Al Jardine's son is in the band as well now, I believe. And I can't tell you how intimate it was when the lights went down halfway through and it was just him at piano doing God Only Knows. And it was like, this is a moment right here. I mean, everyone there was, I guess, my age and older. There weren't a phone out. No one was filming it. Everybody was just, I don't want anything to distract me from what's going on right now. And that was one of the most inspiring and beautiful gigs I've ever experienced. I just wanted to throw that one in.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
Which number one, JP?
Can I have that one?
Pressure.
So, yeah, so it was Tom Waits' Apollo, Hammersmith Apollo, 2004. It was actually I'm a huge Tom Waits fan. And Ms. Loppy signed a publishing deal with Warner. And we jokingly, because it was impossible to get tickets, like you just couldn't get them. So we jokingly made it a condition of our contract. We wrote the contract for our publishing deal because why not? And we made it a condition, and we were sort of joking because, you know, you say those sort of things. Anyway, Warner really was shitting it because it was coming up to this gig and they hadn't secured his tickets. And and they did.
Amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I do believe Tom Waits was quite angry about the, you know, the fact that a lot of people, I think, did similar things, and he's just like, no, you should. Everybody should have equal opportunity to get to this gig, and I totally agree. But I thoroughly enjoyed the gig, and mainly because he did some of the really mad stuff, some of the new stuff, and then out comes the piano, and he does all these jazz, you know, Leonard Cohen-esque ballads, and you're like, oh my God, I got to just watch that for hours. He was incredible, and he really is a performer. Like, he doesn't just play the songs, he embodies each one, and it's theatre, basically, and it's amazing. Yeah, incredible, amazing gig. And I saw Tom York there. It's that kind of gig where you turn around and, like, lots of musicians who are very popular sitting there like fans, because they are fans of music, this is where they're musicians. And it was quite a surreal evening, but he was incredible. Definitely my gig. Yeah, I'm probably on and off probably the artist I've listened to most, weirdly, ever.
So was there What were the almost made it's? What's your honourable mentions? What just got eked out of the five?
Oh, good question. I mean, obviously, the Saul Williams was totally forgotten from my brain. Things like more abstract. I was thinking, because I study jazz music and I love jazz music, there's an Israeli jazz double bassist called Aveshi Cohen. And he plays a little bit like me, where we get up on stage and we're like, could die tomorrow. You know, every note, a bit like Lamb, John Thorne, where they get up and they just own the stage. It's like, I don't care if you're laughing at me, this is what I'm doing, and I love it. He's amazing for that. Actually, Steve Earle at Glastonbury acoustic, I just happened to wander in and he walked on stage, just him and the acoustic guitar, and I was like, what's this going to be like? You know, man's had quite the life. Oh my God. It was mesmerizing. He was just with an acoustic guitar voice. I think his wife came on and sang, one of his wives at some point, came on and sang a few songs with him, but he could hold the audience. You know, I think people were slightly scared to leave. He has that personality where he gets up on stage and is like, I don't play these songs. If you talk, I'll come down there and sort you out. And if you leave, I will say, like in America, he's followed around by the Hell's Angels, love him. So they follow around his tour bus, apparently. And so, yeah. So, yeah, he was just, So those kind of stick in my mind, the gigs I didn't make the list for some mad reason. And now I'm regretting that Metallica did.
Well, it was a very worthy number one as well with Tom Waits. JP. And I guess that brings us nicely towards the end of the podcast. I'd like to find out where can people, if people want to donate to your charity for this, the virtual run for Mighton Hospice, how can they do that, buddy?
If they go to mightonhospice.org/JP, we'll get you there. And Mighton is MYTON and hospice is spelled like hospice, which I'll probably spell wrong. But yeah.
We'll also put that in the bio. For the for this episode, so for those that are listening, head over there, click that link, and support JP.
Thank you. I mean, you don't have to like just give it to Michael, or just give it to Mighton Hospice. You know, it's not. I'm like 900% over my target anyway.
Thanks, Ed.
Exactly.
Jeez. Keep an eye on him. He's going to be big. I'm telling you.
Yeah. I mean, that is genuinely like when I sent him I sent him an email. I thought I just had no concept of what it must be like to be that famous. And then once I'd sent it, I was like, that was slightly ridiculous because there's no way somebody as big as that can, you know, do it, share something. It's not like he sits at home doing his own tweets. So, yeah,
amazing. It would have been weird if he would have just sent a tenner in, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I know. Can you imagine the press though out of that?
Yeah, good point.
or just, I mean, the thing is, it's because I wasn't asking for money, so that's the thing. So, like, yeah, imagine if he just gave a tenner. It's weird. I think I did a local radio show and one of the presenters said, well, you know, he could have given more because he's worth this much money. And I was like, man, that is not the point. It's so crazy. Yeah. I mean, I could probably give more than I do, you know, probably all could.
Absolutely. Joe P, it's been a real pleasure.
Yeah,
thanks so much for your time, man. Best of luck with the marathon. And is it 20K tomorrow?
20 miles tomorrow.
20 miles tomorrow. All right. Well, best of luck with that.
Thanks.
And yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. Real pleasure. Thank you.
It's a drunken soiree in the within.
Chris and Stu present Our Core Listing, the podcast.